I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
For the very last time, it's Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, well, that's too bad, because this is our final episode, the big finale for Shouts from the Back Row, the podcast project that has run for 7 years, and after 7 years of movie and TV discussion, we are finally drawing it to a close. And in honor of almost 300 episodes of the show, we're going to be spending this one looking back on our memories of podcasting together. And you know what, guys? I'm just going to dispense with the formalities right here. There's no sense in standing on ceremony. This is our final episode. So let's start in our traditional way by discussing what we've been up to since last episode, movies and TV shows we've been watching, and games we've been playing and all that jazz. TK, what have you been up to?
It's the season finale of Game of Thrones, which, again, was plagued by poor pacing and, I don't know. Gil, you and I were talking about this earlier.
Yeah, okay. But hang on, though. We can't spoil Game of Thrones anymore. Because Robin has started watching. So
It's going to be a long time, I think, before I get to the finale.
But even so, like, I don't want to spoil, for example, someone significant died, right? And I think, TK, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Indeed.
A prominent character died, and I don't want to say who it is, because I want it to be a surprise for Robin. It's so funny, because we've been spoiling Game of Thrones in front of Robin for 7 years. Like, the Game of Thrones has run as long as this podcast, and up until this month, we've just been talking about everybody, you know, who lives, who dies, what's going on, and it has meant nothing to Robin. But now that he's started watching, I don't want to spoil it. It's funny, the final episode of this show, and we can't spoil Game of Thrones, but TK, I agree with you that there were some missteps. I think it was okay. It was a pretty enjoyable finale that got me excited for next season. That character's death, I think, was sort of due. It was handled okay, but not great. But we've talked about how in seventh season, the showrunners seem very hesitant to kill significant characters. There are a lot of fake outs, and so they finally killed a significant character, and I'm okay with that. I'm good for that. But who, you know, there were a lot of dumb moments too. So a mixed bag as seventh season seems to have been for both of us overall, right? Like, I thought seventh season of Game of Thrones started really good, but ended really bad. What did you think, TK?
No, I agree. I think it had some really good leading. Again, because they're working with unestablished territory, it's a lot more interesting. But I think I don't want to say it's not lost their way. That's not the right word. I think they had a really hard time trying to figure out everything they wanted to put into the last handful of episodes. So that's why everything feels like weirdly
rushed. A lot of it feels really rushed.
Yeah, and some of it feels rushed, but some of it that isn't as significant feels like it drags.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
And like I enjoyed watching, but at the same time, it was just, I don't know.
You know what season 7 felt like to me? It felt like they knew where it had to begin and end, but they just sort of made up what happened in between as they went along. Like, it didn't feel well planned out, but at least halfway through the season, you knew what they were setting up. You knew, like, where all the key players were going to end up in the end. So, I don't know, half well planned? The whole show is sort of hit and miss ever since they ran out of source material to draw from. But hey, speaking of Game of Thrones, Robin, have you continued watching?
Yes, I was going to talk about that and what I've been up to, but I might as well talk about it now. I also saw the season finale of season one of Game of Thrones, and it's quite funny. I was joking when you were asking what do I think is going to happen next when I start watching, and I was making the joke, well, Sean Bean's in it, I'm sure he's going to die, and he died in the very next episode that I watched. Yep. Which is wonderfully unexpected, because it wasn't the season finale, it was the second to last the penultimate season finale, so I kept thinking, well, I have a feeling Ned may die, but it'll be the grand finale of the last episode. But no, they kill him at the end of episode 9, and it's such a great scene because it's a brutal beheading that totally establishes Joffrey's character as like the most despicable person on the show. And I've heard all the stories about how Joffrey became the most hated character in television, and this was finally the episode that showed it. And I think it was especially shocking just because, like, even though it's an ensemble show, Sean Bean gets top billing in the credits because he is the most recognizable actor on the show. So you think, well, at least he's gonna last an entire season. But no, he's in 9 episodes and then 1 episode where it's just his head. So that was very well played. And I felt that the last episode did a good job at setting up the story arcs to lead into next season. Like, it's just introduced new characters like Charles Dance and his relationship with his son and establishing the rivalry. So it's I will be watching season 2 because I really did enjoy season 1 and I thought it did a good job at making me want more. So I won't be able to update it on the podcast, but I will continue watching and we'll season 7.
Well, that's awesome. I'm so glad that you're still enjoying it. And Ned Stark being beheaded, it's funny because we are so many years into the show, but that moment remains so significant. That is the moment that sort of establishes that anybody can die on Game of Thrones. Because, like you said, Sean Bean gets top billing in the first season, and his character is the honorable one. He's the hero. He's basically Aragorn. Like, his character is very much an Aragorn surrogate, and it's funny because, of course, Sean Bean played Boromir in Lord of the Rings, but like, he's that. Any other fantasy franchise, Ned Stark would be the protagonist, and because he's always doing the right thing, he'd be immune to death. He'd have plot armor, but beheading him at the end of the first season threw a lot of people for a loop, and I feel like, you know, Sean Bean was known for dying before Game of Thrones, of course, but I feel like him dying on Game of Thrones kicked off the meme in a really big way. And it was so, like, even when he's the main character, he's not immune to being written off the show and killed off. So that moment is really significant, and it's great to hear that even though you knew Sean Bean was going to die, it still threw you for a loop by happening one episode earlier than you were anticipating.
Just the way the scene is set up, you're expecting like a last minute rescue where it's like somebody's going to intervene at the last minute to save him. But no, they have this horrifying thing where one of his daughters comes and the person says, no, child, don't look at this. Don't look at this. And then they turn her head away and then they chop his head off screen. So it's like, oh my God, did they really do this? So very well handled.
Yeah. And, you know, watching season 7, I'm getting really excited. It's funny to say, I'm excited for the series to end, so that I can go back and rewatch it all in a row. Because with the exception of probably the first 2 seasons, most of Game of Thrones, I've only watched the episodes once when they air. You know, maybe I'll see an episode twice, but I've just been watching it regularly, like as it airs, since the beginning. So and in season 7, there's a lot of character reunions where characters are meeting up who have been on the show the whole time, and they'll say things like, you know, like, oh yeah, I fought with your father at the battle of this. And you remember, like, oh yeah, in season 3, that was the battle, and that guy's dad was there and died. Like, the legacies of these characters are probably my favorite thing about the show at this point, because you can trace them through so many battles and, like, crazy moments. Like, Jon Snow alone, his character trajectory is just so wild and storied that it's pretty amazing to chart its course, and I can't wait to do that again. And also characters like Daenerys Targaryen, where I guess this is a minor spoiler, but it's not really a spoiler. She spends most of the series not in Westeros with the other characters. She's across the sea with the Dothraki, or, like, you know, sailing or things like that. And it isn't until the later seasons that she really sort of gets into the main action and crosses paths with the people of Westeros. So even just charting her character's trajectory to get to that point, I think is going to be pretty fascinating. So for all that TK and I sort of groused a bit about the past couple of episodes of season 7, I think overall this series is just amazing. It's some of the best TV I've ever seen, and even when it's bad, it's still really entertaining. I mean, I don't know about you, TK, but when Game of Thrones is bad, it's still pretty good. I'm like a harsher critic to it because I know how good it can actually be. Is that the case with you?
Yeah, when it's bad, it's almost depressing because you know that there's so much good stuff that they've done in the past, and you can see it kind of slide. That's upsetting to me. Because we know over the past, like they've made amazing episodes, and it's sad to see them fall.
What else have you been up to, TK?
Caught the latest episode of Rick and Morty, which I think is my favorite of the season. Have you had a chance to catch up with this one?
Is this the one where they go to the neurological spa and have their toxicity removed?
Yes. I don't know, there's something about this episode that I thought was fascinating because we get this like really deep look at like what the characters really dislike about themselves, and it's so, I don't want to say it's eerie, that's not the right word, but like it's so funny to see what Rick's toxic self is versus what Morty's toxic self is and how they feel about afterwards, because Morty goes on this big thing where where he feels fine without being whole, without missing all that, but without missing anything, we find that he's actually, I think Morty's creepier without a conscience or without toxicity than Rick is.
Well, the characters get split between it, like they have basically it's their toxicity personified. They have their toxicity removed and their toxicity takes the form of them, but it's like these really awful versions of them that are all their most toxic character traits. And so, Rick is just like a really harsh, mean asshole, and Morty is full of angst. It's like his angst personified. So with his angst removed, Morty basically becomes, as Rick says, like Patrick Bateman, like American Psycho, because he's always really cheerful, but it's like he has no soul. So I really enjoyed this episode too.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It had a couple really, really good moments, and I was pretty happy with it. And other than that, that's all I've been up to, gentlemen.
Robin, what have you been up to?
I've seen a couple new movies. I finally got to see Wind River, the new movie from Taylor Sheridan, who is now becoming one of my favorite filmmakers in Hollywood. As you know, he started out as an actor and then became a screenwriter. He wrote Sicario, and he wrote Hell or High Water, which was one of my favorite movies from last year. And this was his directorial debut, which he wrote and directed, and it's really good. It's a murder mystery, but what Sheridan does so well is establishing characters and bleak, desolate settings, like showing characters having to adapt, like living in like the most depressing places imaginable and doing crime at the same time. Like that's what I loved about Sicario and Hell or High Water, is that they showed like the depressing nature of living in like a poverty-stricken places in Mexico and Texas. And here you're on an Indian reservation in Wyoming, where if a girl gets murdered, she could be like miles from nowhere, and it's like a jurisdictional nightmare just getting the police to come out and investigate it, because they think, oh, a Native American woman is killed. Well, we don't really care about that. So it does a great job at establishing the community. And I think this is a standout performance from Jeremy Renner. His character is not a law enforcement officer. He's kind of like this wildlife game warden who like shoots animals, but he helps law enforcement because his instincts are so good at like tracking the land. And he's a character with a lot of dark secrets in his past and a lot of like, with a tortured soul, and it's great to see his character evolve throughout the course of the movie as he's trying to solve the mystery. I think this is one of his stand-up performances, and I hope Renner gets an Oscar nomination for this one. And also another amazing performance from Gil Birmingham, who played Jeff Bridges' partner in Hell or High Water, and he's only in a couple of scenes here, but he pretty much steals the movie anytime he's on screen, and it's kind of great to see this character actor who's been been around for years, starting to get these great roles in these Taylor Sheridan movies to show what a great actor he is. So I hope he also gets some recognition here. And what I like about Taylor Sheridan is I was reading up a bit on him, and he says that while he was an actor working in television, he developed an allergy to exposition. Like, he, as a writer, he just hates it when the characters just spell out the plot and explain their feelings. He's a big reminder of, like, show, don't tell. And that's what he does here, is he never really, like, explains the plot. He just shows, like, it unfold right in front of you so that you figure out a lot of stuff by yourself. But he trusts the intelligence of the audience. And the narrative is like a slow burn, kind of like his other movies. But once the violence starts, it really, like, takes you by surprise. Like, it builds up to a pretty amazing climax here. So I got to give this one another thumbs up. It's a pretty downbeat, depressing movie, but it's so well done, and I look forward to seeing what Taylor Sheridan does next. I heard his next movie is called something like Soldado or something, that it's a follow-up to Sicario, with bringing back Josh Brolin and Benicio Del Toro, so I'm definitely looking forward to that one, because he's become one of my favorite writers in Hollywood now.
That's great to hear that this one's so good. It's interesting because Wind River was one of the few movies this year where I had to watch the preview on my own. I didn't see a preview for it in theaters ever. And it's one of the few movies this year where I've heard about it through word of mouth. Like, it's been buzz, you know, people going like, oh, Wind River is supposed to be really good. But I haven't, seen any big reviews or big posters for it. So, I don't know, it's kind of cool to have a movie like this where, you know, Jeremy Renner is a pretty A-list actor these days, but it's kind of like set up to be this sleeper hit, a bit like Hell or High Water, where it kind of comes out of nowhere and surprises everyone, even though this is an established director. So it's pretty cool. And I didn't know that about his quote-unquote allergy to exposition, but I appreciate that as well.
Yeah, because I know he was on shows like Veronica Mars and Sons of Anarchy as an actor, so I think this is kind of him getting frustrated by TV writing and just wanting to... I think that's why he transitioned to script writing, because he was so sick of reading bad scripts. So good for him for being so successful at it. And as far as what else I've been watching, I finally got the chance to see Terminator 2 on the big screen for the first time. This is actually the only Terminator movie I hadn't seen in theaters before. I was able to see the original Terminator at the Mayfair here in Ottawa several years ago, and I saw Terminator 3, Salvation, and Genesis in theaters when they originally came out. But this is the granddaddy of them all, so I was looking forward to finally seeing it in a theater. It was re-released with 3D, and they did it this past weekend because it's the 20th anniversary of Judgment Day, August 29th, 1997, and here we are 20 years later, so it was a pretty cool idea for a re-release. I will say that the 3D really didn't add much to it, because the first scene is cool when they're showing, like, the futuristic robot battle. That is kind of cool to watch in 3, but for the rest of the movie, you really don't notice much difference, so it kind of seems gratuitous, but I didn't really care, because just seeing the movie itself was pretty awesome. And just seeing how well it holds up, because as I was watching it, I kept thinking about how they would make this movie today, because I know the liquid metal CGI used on, like, the T-1000 and that was just mind-blowing stuff when it came out in 1991. Like, nobody had ever seen effects like it. But most of the other stuff in here is practical, like the action scenes. And all I could think about it is all these action scenes would be done entirely with CGI today. I kept thinking about that during the climactic chase scene where, like, this tanker truck filled with, like, liquid nitrogen just crashes into a steel mill and the Terminator is just riding on top of it. And all I could think was, wow, I'm just visualizing this being filmed today in CGI and it would probably look awful, but this is like a real practical effect and it looks awesome and it just makes the movie more gritty and realistic. And it is kind of fun to look back at this movie and see it now that, like, they've totally screwed up the timeline with all the subsequent Terminator films. Like, Genesis just kind of rewrote the whole thing and just turned it into a convoluted net. So it was kind of fun to harken back when it was just Terminator 1 and 2, where the timeline was, like, a bit messy if you thought about it too much, but it's like, you, at least you could keep everything straight, but it's kind of like, kind of an awful feeling to watch all the stuff in Terminator 2 and think, well, this has kind of been rendered meaningless now because Terminator Genesis just changed everything and said that none of this actually happened. So that was kind of depressing, but it's just such a great movie overall, and it moves at such a great pace. Like, it has nonstop action, but it knows when to slow down and let you catch your breath, and it's still Arnold at his best. I kind of wish that when this movie came out, they had kept it secret that the Terminator was the good guy, because I know they kind of gave it away in the trailers, but when you're watching the first act of it, it kind of looks obvious that you're supposed to think that the Terminator is the villain and the T-1000 will be the protector. But then when they have the moment where he says, "Get down," to John Connor and reveals that he's protecting him, then it's a pretty big moment, but it comes across so awesomely, and it kind of makes me sad to think about how bad this franchise got after this. But still, if you get a chance, go out and see Terminator 2 on the big screen, because it's still amazing, and it was just so much fun to see in the theater finally.
So I went to see Terminator 2 Judgment Day in theaters as well, and I saw it on August 29th, 2017, like on the day. It was Tuesday night. I didn't go and see the 3D re-release, though. I went and saw it at the Royal Cinema in Toronto, which is a repertory theater, like a third-run theater, and they did a special screening of it, of the extended edition, the special extended edition.
Oh, and, cool, because they didn't have the extra scenes when I saw the 3D version.
Yeah, and I bet they had the theatrical ending as well, right?
Yes, yes, the same ending.
So I saw, I had never seen the full extended edition. I'd seen the alternate ending, and I think I'd seen one or two of the deleted scenes, but it was pretty cool to see them all on the big screen all the way through. And they even did a great pre-show where they showed an entire playthrough of the Terminator arcade game, the shooter game with the light guns. They showed a clip from a Japanese TV show that was a remake of the bar scene where the Terminator walks in naked and takes a guy's clothes, but it ends with the joke that he takes clothes that are way too small for him, so he comes out and he's wearing, like, tight leather shorts and a jacket with the sleeves, like, way up on his biceps. And they also showed some retro commercials from the 90s for the VHS release of Terminator 2, which I was alive when it came out on video, and I remember it being a big deal. That was the first time I saw it, was my dad renting the video, and I remember going to the video store and them having, like, shelves and shelves of Terminator 2 VHS tapes, because it was such a popular movie. And one of the commercials they showed was, it had Robert Patrick introducing it, and it was a commercial meant to entice video rental places to buy large amounts of the Terminator 2 VHS, in a bundle called the T20 pack, which offers you 16 copies of Terminator 2 and 4 copies of Drop Dead Fred.
So, oh, <God.
laughs> what an offer. So,
okay.
Had a good laugh over that. And like you, Robin, I had just a blast rewatching this movie. Terminator 2 for 2 years, basically, between when it came out and when Jurassic Park came out on video, Terminator 2 was my favorite movie, and during that time, I watched the hell out of it. I watched it so many times. I didn't even have an official VHS copy of it for a while, because I was like 10 or 11 years old when T2 was in its heyday, so I couldn't go out and buy a copy of T2 because it was rated R. So I had a copy taped off TV, and it's kind of amazing how much they kept in, but of course, censored a lot of the language, which was pretty funny. So, Terminator 2, it's been one of my favorite movies for a long time. Great to see it on the big screen. Hilarious to see some of the deleted scenes, especially that alternate ending where it flashes forward to the future and Linda Hamilton is in old lady makeup and her voiceover talks about how maybe if a machine can learn to love a human, we can learn to love each other. Or ends on some sort of fruity line like that, which is pretty funny. So, yeah, overall it was really great. Oh, I forgot to mention another moment in the pre-show was it was put on as part of a film series, and the host of the series came out and introduced it, and then they had a guy dressed up like the Terminator come in and drag the host off screaming as he activated the special edition with his remote. So it was just a great time overall. One thing that it made me think of, you know, Robin, you were thinking about, like, just the spectacle of it and how, you know, compared to today, what would it be made? I started thinking about Terminator 2 compared to James Cameron's other films. And I feel, let's see if you guys agree. I think Terminator 2 is James Cameron's best movie. What do you think?
That's a tough one, because I go back and forth. Like, I love pretty much most of his movies. I might give the nod to Aliens, but it's a close one.
What about his best original movie? Because Aliens, of course, is a sequel from a different franchise that it was established by Ridley Scott.
So, oh yeah, I guess Terminator 2 counts as an original if he came up with it. So yeah, I guess it is, because he came up with the original first. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think Terminator 2 is his best movie. And I was trying to think, besides Aliens, I mean, Aliens is also tremendous. I really love it. But I was trying to think of why I liked Terminator 2 so much more than, say, Avatar, or even, like, True Lies, or The Abyss. You know, those are all fine movies. And I came up with an answer, because all of those movies are punctuated by cutting-edge special effects and spectacle. Like, Terminator 2 is mostly action scenes. It does have its lulls, so you can catch your breath, but, like, the final 45 minutes, I think, are just non-stop action, where they go to Cyberdyne, they blow up Cyberdyne, there's a shootout with all the cops, they make a getaway, the T-1000 gets a helicopter, there's a freeway chase, then they wind up in the smelting plant, the T-1000 melts, and then they fight all through the smelting plant. There are multiple Terminator versus T-1000 one-on-one fights, you know? Like, it is non-stop, breakneck action until the end. And I was thinking of why I felt Terminator 2 worked so much better than Cameron's other films. And I feel like it's because James Cameron hangs all of this action and spectacle on a question in each of his movies. And Terminator 2 has the most interesting question. So The Abyss is sort of like, what if aliens were under the sea? True Lies is like, what if your suburban husband was James Bond? Avatar is like, I don't know, what if a soldier went native and saved a tribe of aliens? Titanic is, what if Romeo and Juliet was on a sinking ship? But Terminator, and Terminator 2 especially, the question is, if you could go back in time and kill Hitler, would you? And that is just a fascinating philosophical question on its own. But when you've got two killer robots and amazing action, and certainly at the time, the most mind-blowing special effects you've ever seen, it just all adds up to a really terrific movie. And I think Terminator 2 holds up. I think it's really great. Though, I honestly don't recommend the special extended edition. Just watch the theatrical cut. Like, there's a reason those scenes were cut out of it.
Since you mentioned the kill Hitler thing, one thing I'd completely forgotten about, which I found hilarious here, is that the guy who actually kills Miles Dyson in this movie is Dean Norris from Breaking Bad in an early role. In his entire role, he's wearing a SWAT team mask, which I found pretty funny, but I heard his voice and I'm like, oh yeah, that's Hank. That's one of his early roles.
Yeah, you recognize those eyes too, the very distinctive eyes. But yeah, it was a great time.
And yeah, that's about all I've been up to. I guess I'll mention that there's a new episode of The Trail Went Cold this week. It's my oldest story. It's a unsolved mystery from 1930. And even though this is the end of Shouts from the Back Row, you'll be hearing plenty more of me on The Trail Went Cold every week from here on out.
So besides Game of Thrones and Terminator 2, what I've been up to is I watched The Dark Tower. I watched it, guys. And I'd be curious to see an extended cut of this one, because it's 90 minutes and it feels like a movie that has been cut to ribbons. There's a whole opening sequence that is free of dialogue that introduces the idea of the Dark Tower and Matthew McConaughey as this evil sorcerer who wants to destroy the tower using energy that he draws from the minds of children. But what I just said is exactly what you get and no more. Like, there's a bunch of kids, and then they go into a building, and they're strapped into chairs, and Matthew McConaughey is lurking in the darkness, and then energy comes out of all the kids' heads, and it blasts a dark tower. And then the main character wakes up, and it was a dream. but it goes by so quickly. Nothing is established. Like, I watched, even after the opening scene played, I thought to myself, that wasn't a scene. That was barely a montage. It played like the blurb on the back of a DVD cover, or the blurb in a dust jacket of a book, because it goes by so quickly, it feels so abridged. So, right off the bat, that's a big problem. Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey are fine in their roles, but in fact, you know, that abridging, that cutting, is probably the biggest downfall of this movie. A lot of people complain that it's a lone wolf and cub story that focuses on the kid in that relationship, and the kid here is not very good. That's true, but he's really not that bad for a child actor either. He's just nothing. He's a little too bland to carry the movie. Idris Elba looks awesome. Matthew McConaughey, it looks ridiculous, frankly. One review I read of this said he looked like Chris Angel, like some Vegas magician. And that's true. But that can work for Matthew McConaughey. He can sink his teeth into that kind of thing. Unfortunately, though, nobody's given time. The characters aren't given introductions. The first we see of Idris Elba's character, he's already in the middle of a conversation with another character who then dies in that scene, and Idris Elba acts heartbroken. Was that other character his father? His brother? Just a friend? We don't know. That's it. That's all you get. That's his backstory. Somebody he cared about died. The end. There are these little funny moments. I couldn't help but be reminded of, this is an unfavorable comparison, but I make it favorably. Of course, at some point, Idris Elba's character, Roland the Gunslinger, and the kid slip back through this portal and into Earth, into New York City, and Matthew McConaughey follows and starts sort of tearing up the place behind them. I could not help but be reminded of Masters of the Universe, as Idris Elba, you know, eats a hot dog, and the kid says, "Do you like that hot dog?" And Elba goes like, "What breed is it?" You know, there are funny fish out of water moments where, you know, just, oh, I don't know. At one point, he sees a commercial on TV with a talking animal, and he says, "Oh, do the animals in your world still talk?" Which is like a kind of a neat line to plant. But it's like, no, it's just a commercial. It's all for a gag. I don't know. Like, if anything, The Dark Tower is bad because it squanders potential. I could see the appeal of these characters. And Idris Elba looks friggin' great. But they, you know, maybe he wasn't given enough to do, or maybe there's a story that we're just missing entirely because this movie was chopped up in post-production. I can't really say, but the end result is a mess that alternates between confusing and boring, and in the end, it's entirely forgettable, except for, like, leaving this bitter taste in your mouth, because you know something better could have been made out of this. So, boo, thumbs down. I think I gave it, like, 1.5 stars out of 5 on Letterboxd, because, like, it's almost impossible to follow, simply because of how it clips along. I fully admit that I pirated this movie because I did not want to pay for it, and my intention was to watch it in the background while I did other things, because I was like, this is just going to be boring and stupid. It was the opposite. I had to pay attention because it moved so quickly and, like, left out so much detail that you had to pay attention to what was going on, otherwise you'd be even more confused later. I don't think they ever actually explain who McConaughey's minion guys are, but they're like these weird rat men that wear rubber face masks, I think? I don't know. They're weird. Jackie Earle Haley's in this? I don't know what he's doing. It's strange. It is all very strange, but it had such potential. TK, I know you in particular were kind of looking forward to this, right? I mean, McConaughey and Idris Elba, for one thing.
Yeah, like, together it's a good idea, but the issue is that I loathe the world of The Dark Tower. It's one of those Stephen King. I had a friend in university who like was obsessed with this series and let it flit into like literally every interaction he had with people. And it got to the point where it soured me entirely. So like when I saw they were making the movie, I thought that's kind of cool, but like I didn't really have that interest in seeing it. But like I'm excited to see Idris and McConaughey work together. So like I might catch it, but like I don't know. It's not very high on my list of priorities, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd honestly say don't bother.
I've heard it repeated so many times, but people said that, why would you take a book like The Hobbit, stretch it out to three movies, but take an epic book like The Dark Tower and turn it into a 90-minute movie? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
The interesting thing is, like, I have heard that this is not, it is neither a reboot nor an origin nor a sequel. It's sort of like all of those things in one. I haven't read The Dark Tower, so I don't know if this is exactly on point, but my understanding is that McConaughey's Man in Black and Elba's gunslinger character are sort of locked in this endless battle between each other. They are like these supernatural beings who are destined to fight each other for all time.
Yeah, the books actually loop like right at the end. It's the I think like the end is the first chapter of the first book.
Well, exactly. So if the books loop, the idea behind the movie is that it is the beginning of the next cycle. It's the start of this story over again. So they can kind of tell the story again a little differently without having to adhere too closely to the source material, but, you know, they can also play around with it and, you know, honor the source, blah, 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 blah. The issue isn't necessarily that they're trying to adapt a lengthy book series into one movie. The issue is that they didn't even do that. They clearly, something was really obviously made and then trimmed down until barely anything was left. And I think that is the biggest problem here. So, yeah, such a shame. I also watched the new Adam Wingard film that he made for Netflix called Death Note. And this was based on an anime, which in turn was based on a manga, which I didn't read. Out of curiosity, Robin, I know you're an Adam Wingard fan, like me, or kind of are, at least. I don't know how you feel about him after Blair Witch, but do you have any interest in this? Have you watched it or watched any of the trailers?
Interestingly enough, I am curious to watch it because Death Note is probably the only anime I've ever watched in my life, because I had a coworker who was bugging me to watch this saying, try it out, you'll love it, I swear. And I did enjoy it. I thought the Death Note anime series dragged on way too long, but it did have some really cool ideas. And I also watched the Japanese version of Death Note that they turned into a movie. So I am familiar with the source material, and I'm anxious to see what Adam Wingard will do with it, because I am a fan of all of his other movies besides Blair Witch.
So I am going into this fresh, not knowing anything about the source material except the premise. And I love the premise. It's a really original and interesting idea. The idea that there is sort of this demonic creature who brings people a book. And if you write someone's name in the book, you can write down how they die, but they will die and in a way that you specify. And at least according to the movie, it is a story of this kid who is given the death note by the demon whose name is Ryuk. And in this case, the demon is voice and motion capture performed by Willem Dafoe, which I think is a pretty darn good piece of casting. He's doing his Green Goblin thing here, and it works really well. And the kid, whose name is Light, decides to use this to create a better world, basically. First, he decides to start eliminating all crime and doing it in such a way that it will frighten other criminals into turning themselves in or going straight. And so he creates the illusion of, I guess, a god or some being called Kira, who takes credit for all of these deaths that look like bizarre suicides. This, in turn, leads to a very sort of weird detective investigator named L to take on the case, and he's got his own eccentricities, and it kind of leads to this like cat and mouse mind game where Light has the power to kill people, but he can only kill people if he knows their name and sees their face. And his rival, this investigator named L, covers his face and we don't know his name. And so it does become this, like, cat and mouse game between them, and between L's powers of deduction and Light's powers of death, basically. I read and heard from fans of the anime that the movie doesn't quite do it justice. It is, of course, Americanized, and they don't really adapt the characters well, I hear. Apparently Light is a very different character between the anime and this movie. But not knowing that, I thought it was actually kind of cool. Like, I enjoyed it pretty well. Willem Dafoe obviously steals the show as Ryuk, and the effects work on this demon, this death god, look fantastic. They look really great. Adam Wingard brings some of the things that I love about his movies to this, in particular a lot of scenes in slow motion with 80s music playing over them. And those sequences, like, even though it's kind of a cliche for him to do that at this point in his films, they look great, man. Like, he has not lost his touch in that regard. So the movie is kind of, you know, it's kind of a mess. It doesn't always work, but the premise and some aspects, like those sequences and like Willem Dafoe, are so enjoyable that, I don't know, you know, I'll probably watch it again. It's on Netflix. I guess this is how Netflix gets you, right? What have I got to lose? I've already got my Netflix account. I might as well watch it. So call this one like a mild recommendation. I thought it was pretty good, and I wouldn't. You know, be sad if I watched it again. If anything, though, it has made me really intrigued to watch the anime. So, I guess there's that. So, Death Note, you know, it's okay. And then, the last thing I've been watching is, I haven't finished the first season of Sopranos. I've been pretty busy, but I watched more episodes. And I'm into it now. I think I watched, like, the episodes that were the real turning point of the show. In the episode where Tony Soprano is taking his daughter to look at colleges and, you know, post-secondary education, she asks him if he is in the mafia. And it's sort of like the first major thing that Tony has had to, like, really confront in the series in first season. And so, you know, that intrigued me. But then his son started asking him about it. And now he's developed, like, love, I guess. He's in love. He says he's in love with his therapist. He's started dreaming about his therapist in a few really interesting sequences. And I think the show has hit its stride for me because it's doing the thing that I loved when a show like Breaking Bad did it, where the characters are really well established, and now different TV directors can sort of put their own spin on it. The dream sequences where Tony is fantasizing about having sex with his therapist, they have him singing like 50s doo-wop in one of them. It's really interesting, and it adds some style to the show that wasn't there before. Also, the last episode I watched, we get to see into Tony's past, where he's talking about watching his dad get arrested at a carnival. And, you know, we get insight into how he thinks about, like, the family business of organized crime. I like where this is going, and I'm definitely going to stick with it. And, of course, Robin, you had recommended an episode in third season to me, saying it was, like, the highlight of the show for you. It was one of the best episodes. So I'm definitely watching at least until there. But at this point, I have a sneaking suspicion that by the time I get there, I'm just going to be full into The Sopranos. It has hooked me officially.
Yes!
Yes! Yeah, one thing I gotta mention is this show has amazing dream sequences. Like, there are a few episodes where Tony's entire story arc is a dream sequence, but it doesn't feel like a filler episode because those dream sequences offer so like glaring a look into his psyche and what is going on in his mind that you learn so much about the character just from seeing these like weird dreams and stuff. So that this show is a master at that. It seems kind of weird that a mafia show would be good at this surreal quality dream-like stuff, but they do it so well.
That is fascinating. I had no idea that was such a major aspect of the show, because right from the very beginning, I thought, you know, before they did any dream sequences, they had Tony talking about his dreams to his therapist, and I found that stuff really interesting as well, where he talks about, you know, dreaming that one of the first ones he talks about is he dreams that he has a big screw in his belly button, and he unscrews it, and as soon as he pulls the screw out, his penis falls off. And then one of the ducks that he had been raising in his swimming pool flies away with it. And like it's such a like randomly written thing. It's so well written that you have to believe that like one of the writers on the show had a similar dream, because I don't know how you'd come up with that. But it's interesting. It's really interesting stuff. So it's cool to hear that just the dreams of Tony Soprano continue on throughout the series. I'm looking forward to that. I think it was those types of stylistic elements that I was really missing, because certainly the first like five episodes are very straightforward TV. And as I was saying on our last episode, there's no real antagonistic force in those episodes. It's mostly just seeing Tony doing the business of being a gangster. And now there's some added style to it, where we're getting a little more into his head. We're not just seeing him go through these motions. And I really appreciate that. And then the final thing I want to mention is I had these revelations about Star Wars, guys. I was thinking about Rogue One the other day. And as I recall, we were kind of divided. I really didn't like Rogue One. Robin, you liked it, didn't you?
Yes, definitely.
And TK, where did you fall on Rogue One?
I enjoyed it.
Okay, guys. I'm going to ruin Rogue One. Watch this. In Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader can choke a guy through a video phone. Right?
Yes, that's true. Yes, yes.
Why didn't he just do that? Like... Why don't you just do that?
Yeah, that's true.
You just remote force choke people. Or, if you want something a little more tangible, we know that both he and Luke have the power of stealing something from someone from across a room. We see Vader force grab Han Solo's pistol, and like it whips through the air, and Vader grabs it. We see Luke reach out his hand and pull his lightsaber out of the snow into his hand. So why didn't Vader, instead of cutting down all those rebels, why didn't he just force grab that hard drive, right?
Maybe he hadn't developed that power yet. He didn't get it till after Rogue One ended and A New Hope started.
I guess I can't really argue with that, since it's over a movie later that he does it. But still.
Yeah. I'd much rather see Darth Vader cut down 20 guys with a lightsaber.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, and that's definitely, like, the majority opinion. The other day, when my friend Steve was in town, I took him on a tour of Casa Loma, and I was wearing a shirt with a Star Wars logo, and the guy who tore my ticket said, "Are you actually a Star Wars fan?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What did you think of The Force Awakens?" And I went, "I liked it." And he went, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, but I didn't like Rogue One." And he went, "What?" So
okay. It
definitely seems like a lot of people love Rogue One.
I've never seen that opinion before, someone disliking The Force Awakens but liking Rogue One. That's weird.
Anyway, that is all I've been up to. So now it's time to look back on the history of Shouts from the Back Row. And I thought a really good place to start, I didn't really structure our agenda for this podcast the way I usually do. I just sort of said, hey, you know, come to the table with some of your favorite thoughts and memories and movies we've seen, things we've done, stuff like that. But I thought a good place to start would just be to say, first off, why we are ending the podcast. And it's a really simple one. It's just tough to do week to week. Our lives have gotten pretty busy. Robin and I are working on The Trail Went Cold. TK and I are going to a lot more arts festivals now, and those always take quite a bit of prep time. And, you know, we've got our jobs, we've got our lives. It's tough to juggle all that stuff and do a regular weekly podcast, which is why we've decided to shut it down. That said, we have an extensive backlog of episodes. Our archive on the website goes all the way back to 2013, and I have all the episodes prior to that saved on my computer as well and backed up. So if anybody wants them, you can just get in touch with me. And, of course, the Back Row will continue to publish articles from a lot of our contributors. I know Corey still wants to do writing. Runstedler will probably write every now and again as well. So the Back Row isn't entirely dead, and it's going to stay up as an archive of all of the work we've done, because I think it is just... it's a terrific little monument to our creativity, all the stuff we've done together and all the podcasts we've recorded, all that excellent stuff. And now that I've said why we're shutting down, I'm also going to talk about why I started the Back Row. Because even though you guys, we three, all founded the podcast together, The back row was my brainchild in the beginning. And it came out of two things. The first thing was, back around when we started, like a few years prior, Facebook had become really big, and I used Facebook the way I used the back row, to share just cool videos, because it's almost like a hobby of mine. I just love looking at cool stuff on the internet and sharing it with my friends. Movie trailers, because I'm a movie buff, but also just random videos, things like that. And I also wanted an outlet where I could like write about film. The year before the back row was founded, I was in a film class on teen movies. Like we watched movies like Heathers and Hostel, a lot of teen horror movies, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, things like that. And part of that course in film studies was keeping a blog and writing about movies you watched and writing about teen movies and, you know, analyzing them in blog posts. And then we'd do in-class discussions about each other's blog posts. And I actually ended up getting extra credit because everybody really liked the blog posts I wrote about the movies we watched. So between those two things, me sharing funny links on Facebook and keeping a blog that actually got me extra credit, I started to think I should have a website. And Tom Lando, I gotta give a shout out to Tom Lando. I actually just saw him last weekend, cause he was in Toronto, and he's still Tom Landoing around, guys. He was our co-host for quite a while, for a number of years.
Tom Landoing is a verb.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what he does. He landos all over the place. But, he was one of the people who actually suggested, you know, you need a website to share all this stuff you find. So Tom Lando is sort of inextricably connected to the founding of the back row. I founded it using the popular blog software at the time, B2 Evolution, which has since gone defunct. I don't know, I should have just gone with WordPress from the beginning, because it was a real pain in the ass changing it over at some point, but the site itself went through multiple iterations. It became a multi-site network where we had different podcast projects that I worked on, one of which then took off as the trail went cold. And this podcast, I wanted to start it because one of my favorite things about the film studies program that I was in was the discussions. We'd do a 3-hour lecture, and then the following morning we'd do a 1-hour discussion group in smaller groups. You know, they divided up the lecture hall attendees into much smaller groups, and TAs would do film discussions. And I loved doing the film discussions. I was probably so obnoxious because I was just a total keener. I always had an opinion on films. And it got to the point where our film discussion group was like at 9 in the morning, and a bunch of university students, nobody really wanted to talk except me. So it got to the point where my TA, whose name was Boris, he knew he could always ask me a question and I'd have an opinion. So I kind of took over my discussion group in hindsight, but I wanted to keep that going. The back row was founded the year I graduated, so I wanted to keep that film discussion going. And Robin, I knew you through the screenwriting course we had taken together at Algonquin College. And TK, I knew you just sort of as a friend, and you and I weren't like even super close friends when we started doing this podcast together. Do you know why I picked you for the third host, out of curiosity?
You know what? I actually don't. Please enlighten me. I'm curious on why I've been roped into this for the past 7 years.
Yeah, you just went along without questioning it. You were just like, okay, I'll do a podcast. Little did you know, 7 years later. I
know that I didn't know TK much as well at the time. I know I think I had met him a few times at the Mayfair or something, but it's like I did a podcast with a guy I'd only met maybe two or three times.
Right.
I probably met him at your birthday celebrations as well.
I was going to say, like Robin, you and I met at birthday parties and a few gatherings before we started the podcast. I remember that much.
Yep. So TK, I knew you were a fan of movies, of course, but what sealed it was when you and I were taking part in an old tradition we used to do called beer bogging, where we would go out to an icy hill in Almont, Ontario, and we'd put all of this beer in the snow at the bottom of the hill to keep it cool, and then you'd hurl yourself down the icy hill in a very painful way and get to the bottom and drink a beer, and if it still hurt, you went back up to the top, and you did it all again until it stopped hurting. you and I were out beer bogging with a big group of people, and as you staggered drunkenly back up the hill, you said to me, "Jackie Treehorn treats objects like women, man." And I was like, this guy will be perfect for this podcast.
Oh, buddy. The Big Lebowski pays off. Pays
and
off
I was
everything.
Right, damn it. I was absolutely right. And here we are many years later after so much film discussion. So, guys, I said, you know, bring some things you wanted to talk about to the table. I have a big, long list. I have questions to ask you and probing inquiries, if you will. But I'm going to turn it over to you guys first to hear what you want to talk about when you think of the history of Shouts from the Back Row.
Well, I still remember our origin story. We like to joke about it. Is we came to your house and we talked in front of a crappy microphone. And it's kind of funny that our first podcast was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And it kind of showed kind of our diverse taste because you guys were big fans of the graphic novel. And I was a guy who had never read any of the novels before. And it's you can kind of do a parallel with the way we're ending with Game of Thrones, that we were ending it off by you guys talking about it, who's been watching it for the past several years, and I'm watching it for the very first time, just getting started. So it was always fun to get that perspective on different things where we would sometimes agree to watch the same thing like throughout the course of a week, but some of us would be very familiar with it and others were not. And it would be great to have these different perspectives about how, like, say, TK, what did he think after watching The Godfather for the first time? So that was part of the fun of the podcast, is introducing things to each other that we had not seen before and finally getting to discuss them afterwards.
A lot of our early episodes were us very much figuring out the format that we wanted to take. You know, for years now, we've been doing this format where I do an introduction, then we talk about what we've been up to. We have a main discussion topic, and usually there are a few types of sort of templated episodes that we do. Sometimes we talk about a director's entire filmography or like an actor's filmography. Sometimes we do our top three lists, our top three favorite of something. And sometimes we'll give each other movies to watch and we talk about all those movies together, kind of like a book club. And those first few episodes, we were really just doing like one movie where we do a main review. We do like a little bit of talk about other things we were watching, but it was just like a central review podcast, which is the format that a lot of other movie podcasts were doing at that time, like the Slash Filmcast, which was a big influence on me. But it's funny to see that evolution where we started by talking about, you know, Scott Pilgrim, and then our second one was The Expendables. And then after a while, we were like, well, no, let's talk about why limit ourselves to one movie? Let's talk about different movies. And for a very brief period, we were doing top five lists, but Tom...
Oh my God, our Coen Brothers podcast was like 3 hours.
Yeah, we have... can you blame us, though? Really? But this is another Tom Lando influence. Tom is sort of obsessed with the number three. Three is his lucky number. So he said, let's just make it our top threes. And that stuck for years and years and years. It was our top threes for a very long time. And yeah, that conference mic, just to touch on that too, I was a poor, broke student at the time. So I had yet to figure out, like, I thought you needed a mixer board to record a podcast through Skype. And so, again, for those first few episodes, I was like, I'm just going to get a microphone, whatever I can get my hands on. And it was a crappy conference mic, and I'm kind of embarrassed by how low quality those early episodes are. There may be a reason they're not on the website anymore. TK, do you have any fond memories of that era, the early days?
I remember us being, because we'd all be in the same room, and I don't think the mic had a mute function. So, like, when one of us was talking, the other two would have to sit there really quietly to make sure that we didn't interfere with the mic notes. I remember, like, me pulling notes out of my pocket once and kind of feeling a little self-conscious because I couldn't remember a bunch of actors' names I'd had written down. Like, the room was small, the three of us, like, it was a cramped, quiet time for all of us. But, like, I just remember the... Like, not to say it was an effort, but, like, Robin and I lived on the west end of the city, and you lived in the east end at the time. So, like, we'd have to drive all the way out to get to your place to record, which was fine. But I remember it it interrupted a bunch of movie stuff. Like, I would be just finishing something, or like, and I would have to run out the door to get there in time, and just, I don't know. It was, it was fun. And we were all, I think we all kind of enjoyed the camaraderie for a bit, but my God.
Jeez, I mean, it didn't take
that
long.
Holy jeez!
Yeah, it didn't take long before I was like, "Nada, this is not sustainable. We obviously need to find a way to do this remotely and do it over Skype." But because it was just an inconvenience for everybody. But in the end, it sort of became like, you know, we really did grow out of nothing. We came from nothing. We built ourselves up to what we are today. Here we are, almost 300 episodes later, and we came from such humble beginnings, stuck in my tiny little office, huddled around a shitty microphone, trying not to sneeze and, like, trying to keep quiet. So it is pretty funny to look back on that time. And, yes, I still have those episodes.
It's still funny that one of our earliest episodes during the times where we had to, like, travel to your place was so we could have a screening of The Brothers Grimm, which is just this obscure movie, but we did an entire podcast devoted to it because we had such diverse points, because you and I didn't like it, but TK and Caitlin liked the movie, so we all watched it together and then got around the microphone, all four of us together, to give our differing opinions about it. But it said so much about this podcast that we could fill up like an hour and a half just talking about The Brothers Grimm.
That was some quality debate.
I'm just going to point out that I am the only remaining member of Team Grimm, because Caitlin dropped out, as I recall, recently. Didn't she rewatch it and said, God, it's bad?
Okay, so recently, but really recently, I think is about 2 years ago, and she had tried to watch it on her own and thought it was terrible, and just it didn't hold up. But then one Christmas, I was at home visiting my parents, and it was on TV. We were surfing through the cable channels, and it was on TV, and I went, oh, do you want to watch it? And she was just like, no. The movie had lost its luster. So, yes, you are the final remaining survivor, the final Team Grimm member. But, you know, that is
the cactus.
Those early episodes, there were a few times where we'd all get together and watch a movie and then do a podcast about it. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't miss that. I think some fun, like one of them was Love Exposure. You remember watching Love Exposure together? Like the 4 hour of Tom Lando again.
Yeah.
Tom Lando is like one of his favorite movies. This 4 hour long movie that I got to say, it's not boring, but man, it is a hell of a thing to watch all in one go and then talk about.
Yes. Like, that's the thing of the beauty of Tom Lando is we probably never would have heard of that movie unless it was because of him. And he is so obsessed with it that we just had to watch it together. And it really said something when we watch it and the end credits didn't start till an hour into the movie. Or the opening credits.
Yeah, the opening credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, that was a heck of a time. TK, what are some of your podcast memories?
I enjoyed when we went to Fantasia, the three of us. I thought that was a lot of fun. We all piled up and crammed in a tiny hostel and watched, I think, like 6 movies in a couple days or something. 6 or 5?
Something like 6.
We watched a lot and it was fun. I think there's a review video of us floating around YouTube of us like giving like little one shot reviews on a couple of the films we've seen. That was fun. I had a good time with that trip. But I really liked is that a couple of years later, we all went to Fantasia Fest, but we weren't there at the same time. Like I saw Frank, I was in Montreal very briefly, and like you guys were there for a couple of days each, but didn't overlap. And like
I was there for 2 weeks actually.
So we still had a Fantasia podcast, but it was all kind of peppered. I thought that was fun.
Yeah, Fantasia is another thing that's sort of been part of the back row since its beginning. 2010, the summer of 2010, right after I got the back row set up, like right at the very beginning, I then went to see some movies at Fantasia 2010 with Tom Lando, and those movies were still some of the best I'd seen. Black Death, the Christopher Smith film, and Centurion from Neil Marshall. It was great going to see those, especially those are wild films to look back on, because Neil Marshall, of course, went on to direct a lot of big stuff, stuff like The Descent, but he also directs a lot of Game of Thrones now. And Black Death has the dubious honor of being an Eddie Redmayne film. He's Eddie Redmayne in the lead role. Yeah, if I only knew, I got to sit. I was in the front row, not the back row, the front row for that screening, and Eddie Redmayne was there because he was a nobody at the time. So I was in the presence of an actor who I would go on to loathe over the course of the podcast. But there
I
was.
Well, you were talking about Terminator 2, if you could go back in time and prevent things.
Prevent Eddie Redmayne, if I could just tackle Eddie Redmayne.
But you could have saved us from so much. Boy. Michael Keaton would have that goddamn Oscar if it wasn't for you.
Oh, that's right. Oh, my God. I'm the reason that Michael Keaton didn't get his Oscar. What have I become? But I enjoyed going to those handful of screenings at Fantasia so much that the next year, after we were a year into our podcast, I was like, guys, we should go and see some of these movies in Montreal together. And yeah, we went and we saw a whole bunch of them together, stayed in a hostel. TK, I remember you had really bad insomnia at the time, and you did not sleep well at the hostel.
Oh,
and,
no, not at all.
And then Hell Driver was one of the movies that you saw, and your review, you're just so tired, and you're like, it was so loud. It didn't need to be that loud.
That was... I fell asleep during one movie. Oh, that the Scandinavian Santa Claus one. I fell asleep in the second
half.
That's
right.
Sinterklaas.
And Heaven's Story.
What's your least favorite movie you saw at the festival, TK?
Oh, God. Heaven's Story. Four and a half
Heaven's
hours.
Story.
Pain. I shouldn't say pain. It was
excruciating.
Glad...
You can say pain.
It was excruciating, but I'm glad I saw it to know that a film doesn't have to seem epic to be good. Like they tried so hard to make it so interesting, and they succeeded in some areas, but they devoted so much time to just stuff that should have been cut. Like, the film would have been good if it had been maybe 2 hours. But the fact that it dragged, we'd watch an entire rice ball get eaten. There'd be so many bits and pieces that just wouldn't have pulled together. I don't know. God, like I said, I'm glad I watched it, but Jesus H, that was a rough film. That was a rough one to get through.
I think it's because we had seen Love Exposure a few months earlier, and we saw on the program, oh, a 4-hour Japanese film, just like Love Exposure. We don't know anything about it, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. It might be quirky and cool like Love Exposure, but it was anything but. It was like Tom Lando's review, 4 hours of showing us that everyone in Japan is sad.
Well, and another thing, we weren't just like, oh, 4-hour Japanese movie equals Love Exposure. Fantasia is like a genre festival, so we expected something crazy in like sci-fi or horror or something, but Heaven's Story was just a drama. But on top of that, Fantasia was where Tom had seen Love Exposure originally. So there was precedent for this kind of thing being good, but it was the first movie we saw, and it was just so boring. And I disagree. I don't think making it shorter would have helped. I think it is just a bad, boring movie. I will never forget, though, when it ended... TK jumped out of his seat and said, "Finally!" And then we left. And somewhere...
Well, I remember you saying one of the positive things you heard about the film is that at the intermission, only half the people in it left.
That's right. That's right. Somewhere, maybe I still have it on a hard drive, but in addition to that review video where we were all just giving our thoughts on various movies we'd seen as we came out of them, I also have just a video of us walking away from the theater, me being like, "What'd you think of Heaven's Story?" And TK just being like, "Oh, fuck Heaven's Story. What the fuck was that?" Just like, so much hatred.
Oh, that man, I'd love to see that one, because the only one that's up is that review one. Oh, God, that'd be great.
You know, I'll see if I can find it. If I can find it, I'll put it on the back row for people to watch, but I don't know. It might be long gone at this point. It was quite some time ago. But also continuing Fantasia's relationship with the back row, in 2014, I won an award for one of my short films, and the prize was an industry pass to Fantasia. And... at the time, our friend Grant, who has been on the podcast, he was on one about short films. At the time, Grant's friend's mother owned an abandoned retirement home that was just empty, and she'd been using it as just like renting it out almost like an Airbnb, but she wanted to turn it into student housing. And so I cut a deal where I would photograph the whole place so that she could use it to like get funds, or I guess rent it out, or even sell it. And in exchange, she just let me stay at this abandoned nursing home for free for 2 weeks. And that was a really surreal experience, because, of course, there was no internet there, there was no phone there, and it was in a very isolated part. Like, it wasn't on the main Montreal island, it was across the water on the other side of the bridge. And so it was just a surreal experience staying there at night, and then during the day, just going and watching as many movies as I wanted, because the industry pass gets you into every screening. So I watched at least 30 movies. Somewhere I have a list, but I watched so many movies while I was there, and it was a damn good time. And then Robin came and stayed with me for a little while in the abandoned nursing home.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was an eerie and weird experience. And then, of course, TK, you went later and just went on your own and saw Frank. So the Fantasia Film Festival has definitely been something that we came back to a few times over the course of the back row. And I really want to go again at some point, because it's a fun time. I like that festival. They play my kind of stuff.
What was really funny is that when I went to go see Frank, like, we hadn't been in like 2 years, and there's two things that happen when a film is about to start. The first is that there's a guy who comes up to the front of the stage, and he like dramatically turns the lights off on either side of the theater, and people clap and cheer for him. And then when the theater goes quiet, people start to meow. And I had forgotten about that entirely. So like for half a second, I was super confused. And then I'm like, oh yeah, no, this is a thing.
As far as I know, those traditions are ongoing, so some things never change. I follow the Fantasia Festival on Facebook, and this year, I think they just ended, but they posted a photo of that same MC with his remote control, so they still totally do the lights thing.
Okay, that's stellar.
One other thing I wanted to mention about Fantasia Fest is that it gave us pretty much our only example that we know of a filmmaker who actually listened to our podcast, because we went to see the movie Monster Brawl there, which is a movie about monsters having wrestling matches. So, of course, I was going to jump on the opportunity to see it. And
with Dave Foley.
Yes, Dave Foley. But the funniest part about that is that they had a Q&A afterwards, and they said that Dave wanted to be here, but he is unable to set foot in Canada right about now. And we're like, oh, what's that about? So we actually discussed that on the podcast when we were talking about seeing Monster Brawl, and we were wondering, yeah, we're really curious about why Dave Foley is unable to set foot in Canada. And then we actually got an email from the director of Monster Brawl, Jesse Cook, and he said, oh, in case you're wondering, guys, Dave Foley can't set foot in Canada because he's got a bunch of back child support he hasn't paid yet, so he'll probably get arrested if he crosses the border. But it just blew us away, saying like, oh my God, Jesse Cook actually listened to our episode. That is so cool. But the whole experience seeing Monster Brawl was awesome, because we got to meet him afterwards. They had a cast like Q&A and autograph signing, so we got to meet him, and we got to meet Art Hindle, who's a very famous Canadian character actor who was in it. And we also got to meet Robert Millay, who was a former WWF wrestler named Kurgan, who has also done a lot of big Hollywood stuff. He was in Sherlock Holmes playing one of the villains. But that's the one example I know of where a filmmaker actually emailed us after listening to one of our podcast episodes. So that's one of our coolest memories, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really wild experience. I'll never forget getting that email and just being like, oh my God, guys, somebody listened. Not only did somebody listen, but one of the filmmakers listened and answered our question.
I think he was really excited because we were one of the very first podcasts to talk about Monster Brawl, because I don't know if that was its first screening ever, but it hadn't been released anywhere at that point. But afterwards, it's become somewhat of a cult following, because I see it. I remember seeing it at Walmart on DVD like a couple months later, but I think we were one of the very first people to ever see that movie.
And you know what? I'll give it another recommendation here. It's exactly what it says on the box. If you want to see some monsters wrestle in a brawl, this movie is for you.
I mean, that's pretty much all there is to it, but, like, it delivers what it promises, so that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. It's just what it says on the box as well.
Yeah.
So, here's something funny. We even touched upon it. You won't hear it by the time this episode airs, because I'll have edited it out, but you know what a real tradition on this podcast is? Technical difficulties, guys. I'm going to be honest. I don't re-listen to the podcast exactly. Like, I listen to it once through while I edit it. But after that listen through, I don't really revisit them very much. I'm sure I will to get nice and nostalgic now that we're wrapping it up. But so I don't know how obvious it is to the listeners, but this podcast has been plagued by technical difficulties forever. Sometimes it's bad internet connections, sometimes it's broken microphones. For a while I was using a piece of software where occasionally it would just fail to record everything, so there's at least two episodes that are just lost because we recorded the whole thing and then I went to export it and the software crashed and we lost it. I know we did an episode on biopics that never really got a release, and I know we did an episode on the Bechdel test, which was a really interesting discussion, but alas, the recording fucking failed, and I deeply regret that. Oh, man. And, yeah, even earlier in this episode, TK was having some mic difficulties. So technical difficulties are definitely a back row tradition, and I thought I'd have a good laugh about that. But
I remember there was one where we kept losing people on Skype or Google Hangouts, and it was afterward TK said how much I think he hated Jared Leto or something like that, and it was near the end of the episode, and we just could not finish it without, like, the audio cutting out, so it's almost like Jared Leto is interfering with our feed.
That's right. I think that was even, like, within the past year. It was just,
yeah.
It was Jared Leto. It's not just Jesse Cook that listens to this podcast. It's Jared Leto, and he does not like us one little bit.
It's true. We hadn't even released it yet. We were recording it live, but he was very unhappy. Probably.
Yeah, he's listening. He's got my phone tapped. We must have given him an unfavorable review years ago, and ever since then, he's been obsessed. Hey, I got a question. TK, why are you called TK?
Why am I, like, the actual story on why I called TK?
Yeah, I don't think anybody actually knows this. Your name is Chris.
My name is Chris.
Your name is Chris, and it's not even spelt with a K.
No, it is not. The reason it is that when I started university, the group of people I started to hang out with had four Chris's, including me. So we differentiated each other based on physicality, because it was easier. We had Big Chris, who was fairly large. We had Bearded Chris, who had a beard, obviously. I was the tallest out of all of them by a significant margin, and my other friend Chris was the shortest, so he was Little Chris, and I was Tall Chris, because we already had a Big Chris. And people started calling me Tall Chris, and then they started calling me TC, and then one of my friends said that sounded ridiculous, so they started calling me TK for Chris. So that's why they had hence the nickname from there.
So what's funny about that is the art festivals that you and I go to, we hang out with a group called the Toten Kittens. They call their camp Toten Kitten, and for short, they refer to them as TK. So that's confusing.
Sorry.
But on top of that, I find it really funny because you also frequently sport a beard. So you could be Bearded Chris. What the hell?
Yeah, but I only grew the beard, I think, actually about the same time we started the podcast. I was clean shaven for
you and I, yeah, it's true. I was clean shaven as well in those early years. You and I both saw how good Robin's beard looked. And so we both grew beards to imitate Robin. And then Robin shaved his beard.
Yeah.
What the hell?
And you guys haven't gone back yet.
Well, we're waiting for you to grow a beard so we can shave ours.
As a side, Robin, please don't do that. Because my beard takes way too long to grow in.
But that's the story of TK. So we could be calling you BK, the Burger King.
You very well could.
Why didn't I think of this sooner?
Last episode, guns are out.
Guns are out. Okay, Burger King. Robin, do you have another talking point you want to mention?
Yes, another fond memory of one of our non-Fantasia Fest screenings where we started the tradition of batshit insane movie countdown, and Gil's pick was Jupiter Ascending, and he was so excited for it, and they kept delaying it and delaying it and delaying it, so that I know you predicted it for 2014, and it didn't even come out till early 2015, and we knew that was an ominous sign that this movie was going to be a disaster, and it finally got to the point where, well, if this movie's finally out and we have to see it together, and we finally went to see it at the cinema, and to this day TK has never forgiven you for it.
Yeah, I mean, Jupiter Ascending was the start of the batshit crazy movie countdown, because originally it was just the Jupiter Ascending countdown, and I started counting down the days because it was a joke. I started as a joke. I mentioned this last episode, but I just thought Jupiter Ascending looked insane and kind of dumb. And again, I'll reiterate, this is a movie about Channing Tatum playing a werewolf space elf with rocket boots, and he has to save Mila Kunis, the queen of the universe, who works as a toilet cleaning chambermaid. So it's, and Sean Bean is in it, and he's part B's Sean B. And on top of that, we later find out he doesn't even die. You expect, he's a bee. You figure he gets to sting someone once and then die. That's like their thing. And he doesn't die. Like, oh man. And it birthed my hatred of Eddie Redmayne. That movie was a real sort of milestone in this podcast. It started an entire segment because I had so much fun. Not only did I have so much fun counting down until the release of Jupiter Ascending, and especially listening to TK go, like, this movie's going to be terrible, guys. Why are we even talking about it? But then it got delayed, and our countdown for it went, like, over a year. I believe we went way past 365 days in the countdown just to get to the release of Jupiter Ascending. And then we all went and saw it, and you know what? It's not terrible. It's dumb. It's flashy, but it's certainly original. I think it's a lot better than a lot of the movies I ended up seeing. It's better than The Dark Tower by several miles, I think. So that experience for me really paid off in ways I could not have anticipated. TK, is it true? Have you forgiven me?
No, that was a terrible film. Holy geez. And you know what made it absolutely the worst? And this is one of the main reasons I'll push on this. First of all, they didn't kill Sean Bean. They had lots of opportunities to. And it had Eddie Redmayne. And I know this was filmed before he did the Stephen Hawking film. But it came out really close to the Oscar season for this. So to see him win and then see the shitty acting he can do was such a brutal kick in the teeth. And what made it crazy is that there's a sequence right in the middle of the film that I really, really, really like. So it shows that the directors actually know what to do to make a movie enjoyable to me. And like they just squandered everything else for the rest of the film. That was ridiculous. This, oh God.
Hang on, you like the intergalactic DMV montage?
That was amazing. That was like the coolest part of the whole film. That was so funny, the fact that you would have to get registered as Empress of the Universe. That's so funny. And it was done in such a creative way, and the sequence ends with Terry Gilliam. It was so cool. And like, if the movie had been more like that and less garbage, I think I would have enjoyed it more.
Aw, too good. Too good. But see, it brought us so much, and it definitely brought us the batshit crazy movie countdown, which had some fantastic films that we ended up watching, like The Lobster. I think we can all agree that that's just a straight up good movie, and Swiss Army Man. It was Robin and my like movie of the year. It was so good. So yeah, you know, if nothing else, I think Jupiter Ascending actually wound up contributing a lot to our podcast discussion. Even if the movie is largely forgotten, its legacy here lives on.
Well, yeah, that was the best thing about it, is we were so worried that after all that hype, it's going to be generic and boring. And, I mean, I can't say it's good, but it wasn't boring, and it wasn't generic, and there's so many memorable things about it that I still remember to this day. And Eddie Redmayne's performance where he talks like this and starts screaming will live on forever.
I create life! Amazing. Oh, man. I should rewatch Jupiter Ascending. TK, got any other podcast memories you want to discuss?
I enjoyed the I enjoyed all the podcasts where we made each other watch films we hadn't seen. Like, I saw a lot of really cool stuff I'd never catch before from you guys. Like, oh my gosh, and now this is awful because now I'm trying to think of examples and now I'm stuck.
I mean, we were talking about this topic on last episode too, our like bucket list movies, like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, right?
Yeah, I saw that early on. Or I saw that in Goodfellas really quickly because you guys were giving me shit about them.
Oh yeah, Goodfellas. I still can't believe that it had taken you that long. Like that one's really terrific, man. I mean, Good, the Bad, the Ugly is also great, but I know what a fan of gangster stories you are, and Goodfellas to me is, in some ways, I like it better than The Godfather. You know,
it's cool. Like I don't know. I really like The Godfather Part Two a lot. So I would have to rewatch Goodfellas because it's been a long time since I've seen it.
I mean, it's got good. You know what The Godfather doesn't have is Joe Pesci doing his whole, "What, you think I'm funny? Am I funny to you? What, I'm like a clown here to amuse you?" Really just one of the best Joe Pesci performances ever.
And then he shoots Christopher Molsanti in the foot. It's great. And then kills him. It's fantastic.
Yes. A lot of actors from The Sopranos who had small roles in Goodfellas, and seeing Christopher from The Sopranos get shot in the foot is pretty amazing in retrospect.
Actually, the reason Chris, I don't know the actor's actual name. That's awful. The reason
Michael Imperioli.
Yeah, thank you, Imperioli. The reason he got the job on The Sopranos is because he was in Goodfellas.
I'm not surprised at all. But yeah, you know what? Sorry, go ahead, Robin.
But yeah, just a prime example of a movie that I made you guys watch was the very first Robin's Underrated Gems column I wrote, The King of Comedy, which virtually no one I know had ever heard of, but I was always like, this is the most underrated Martin Scorsese movie. Robert De Niro is amazing in this. And then years later, I finally chose it as the one for you guys to watch, and you finally got an opportunity to see it and loved it. So I was very appreciative of that.
And you know what? It has it has really become a cult movie I've heard more about. Maybe it's just that Bader-Meinhof phenomenon where, you know, you hear about something for the first time and then you see it everywhere. It could just be that happening. But since watching The King of Comedy, I have been noticing it a lot more. I know Edgar Wright wrote about it as one of his favorite films and one of the films that influenced him the most. And Jerry Lewis just passed away, and I heard The King of Comedy cited everywhere as the must-see Jerry Lewis movie. Almost, like, well, definitely overshadowing his slapstick comedy. I feel like The King of Comedy is the thing that he did that is probably going to endure for much longer. So it's neat to see kind of that film gaining more traction in the wake of having seen it for the show. Like UTK, I absolutely love doing those. They're book club episodes. I just call them book club episodes, where we all have to sort of do a bit of homework in preparation for them and watch these movies. And I always have a good time, you know. I can't think of a time where I've really hated a movie that you guys have recommended to me, which is a good sign. But it's really great. Sort of building off of that point, a pattern we all started noticing as we would do these episodes is TK would pick a classic film, Robin would pick something from the Grindhouse era of like the 70s or 80s, and I would pick something more modern, probably after the 2000s. And I can't remember how that pattern got established. I know that...
Oh, I know how.
Well, I was going to say it's because you guys picked from eras that are your favorite eras. Like, Robin, I know that you love the 70s and 80s in cinema, and TK, I know that you love classic films, right?
That's true, but the kicker for me is that I've seen so many more of those movies than you guys have, so it was really easy for me to pick something like pre-1960, because you guys, there's a strong chance you guys wouldn't have seen it as opposed to anything else I could have picked for like the Halloween episodes. Like, a lot of the stuff I've seen, you guys have caught up with. I'm like, well, I've seen all the Universal movies and you guys haven't, so it's just easier to pick. That's why I started doing all the classic stuff. Because then I could actually pick something you guys haven't seen.
That makes a lot of sense. And but on top of that, like, am I wrong in thinking that you guys, your favorite eras were those eras that you picked from? Grindhouse era for Robin and classics for TK?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because I think most of them were from the 70s and 80s. There's just so many of my favorite movies are from that era. And I particularly, that was my favorite era for horror movies. So, of course, when we did our Halloween episodes, that's where I usually picked from.
And the result of that is me picking more modern movies, because I wouldn't say, like, I'm a huge fan of modern cinema overall, but I certainly keep up to date. Like, I watch a lot of movies, and I watch a lot of new releases as they come out. And so I kind of fell into picking the modern films that you guys hadn't seen, because not only had you guys seen so much from those eras, but it meant that, like, I was kind of left with, you know, what else would I choose? I could go all the way back to the silent era and really challenge you guys by making you watch some very early, like, D.W. Griffith or something. But no, I went for more modern films, a bigger amount to pick from. And I think the result is pretty cool. It meant that a lot of those book club episodes that we did were like a trip through movie history, where we get a little sample of all these different eras of cinema.
I do recall that there were a few times when you chose more artsy experimental stuff, and I seem to recall that there were a few that TK absolutely hated.
Oh my god, El Topo and
yes, Hulk, that's what I was thinking of.
Jesus. Like, they were interesting to sit through, but, like, I would like that time back.
You didn't like Howzu either, yeah, that's right.
And I don't know why, I just thought it was poorly put together. But like they were interesting to watch, but at the same time, it's part of a point. It's like, what am I doing? Like, it's an hour in. Like, what? Like, it's just, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad I could challenge you, sir. Because absolutely. Like you said, you know, those are movies you'd never seek out on your own.
No, and that's the fun of doing it, right? Is that it gives you an opportunity to at least expand the wheelhouse, which I thought was always fun. Robin, I really liked when you picked that R-rated Hitchcock movie. Was that Delirious or was that Frenzy?
Frenzy.
That was great. I really liked that one, and I never would have found that on my own, I don't think, ever.
Yes, I had never known anyone who had seen that movie, but I wanted to introduce you guys to it. Like, this is Hitchcock doing R-rated Grindhouse at the tail end of his career, so I wanted to get you guys exposed to that one.
Yeah, that was a really good one. And, you know, you've mentioned Robin's underrated gems and sort of your favorite eras of film and the movies you made us watch. That kind of leads me to remembering, well, just thinking about what a pleasure it's been podcasting with you, Robin, because you have such an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema. There was a running joke for a long time about you, like, you're the Rain Man of this podcast, because even just now, you filled in the blanks where TK was like, oh, what was that guy's name? Michael Imperioli. It's really a pleasure it's been a pleasure podcasting with you and talking about movies, just because, I don't know, it's kind of like having Wikipedia as a co-host. At any point, I can ask you for something, you'll be like, oh yeah, I know that. It's pretty cool.
And one of the fun parts of doing the early ones in the same room is that you knew I wasn't just looking it up on Wikipedia as you were recording it. You were in the same room as me and just seeing just pop out of my head, and you were like, oh my god, how do you do that? And that's where I came with the line, I'm the Rain Man.
Yep. Yeah, it was. There's definitely more than one moment where you'd pull out some random fact, just, and not even like you had it ready. Like, it was just us being like, oh yeah, I wonder what that was, and you'd be like, oh, it's this, just offhandedly, and it blew all of our minds. It really did. Still blows my mind. I mean, I think I got a pretty good knowledge of film, but man, oh man, it still doesn't compare. It's all that time you spent working at Blockbuster, I bet.
I think so. I watched so many obscure stuff because I had 10 free rentals a week, so I would just take home stuff, and that's where I would discover a lot of these underrated gems. But that's what's great about the podcast, is that I can finally have an outlet for it, and just writing at the back row as well, because I'd have all this obscure knowledge, but it's like you can't really engage too many regular people about this without driving them crazy, so that was the fun about getting to talk about it on the podcast. But I think it really said something when you were questioning me last week about, are there any classics that you haven't seen? And I'm thinking, well, not too many good movies. Hocus Pocus, maybe? Because that's a childhood favorite that I know a lot of people I know love, but I've never actually seen it. But it's like, when Hocus Pocus is the one that you haven't got around to seeing, I think that says a lot.
Oh, man, yeah. Just amazing. I have a question. This is the final question that I have for you guys that builds off of that. But I thought I'd ask you guys first, are there any topics that we haven't covered yet that you want to make sure to mention? a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, like Fantasia festivals and Jupiter ascending, those things are on my list as well. So what about you guys?
Well, since we were talking about my knowledge of movies, one thing this podcast has done a lot for me is open up my horizons for trying new TV shows, because in the past I would be kind of slow to start new series. Like just the fact that I'm only starting Game of Thrones now shows that I can sometimes be slow to the gun on that. But what I've loved about this series is getting to see some of our favorite TV shows and getting to review them as they were going along. I think the two prime examples of it are, or the three prime examples are Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, and Boardwalk Empire. Because Breaking Bad was one where I kind of jumped on it pretty late. I think I started watching in like 2012, but by the time we reached the final season, we were all watching it together and we got to review each individual episode of the final season before it ended and then do an overall podcast on it. And we did the same thing with Better Call Saul, where we saw the beginning of it and we've reviewed each season and each episode as it's gone along, and it's been so exciting to see that show evolve. And Boardwalk Empire, where you guys started watching it as, I think it started right around the same time that the podcast started, and you guys were following it as live, but I took a while to finally get started, and I finally caught up for it, and then we finally reviewed the final season together live and did the series finale together live. So that's been one of the funnest part of the podcast, is getting to do some of our favorite TV shows live as they've gone along and getting to review them together when they finally came to an end.
Absolutely.
I wanted to jump on that because I remember, I think a couple of months before True Detective was released, there was a point on the podcast where I asked, like, have you guys heard about this detective show that stars Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey? You guys are like, no. And it turned out to be like one of our favorite series, I think, like that year. That was fun. Doing True Detective was cool, right? Because Gil and I would watch it week to week, and then Robin, you binged it. So we had these two neat perspectives on it, where we had the, cause Gil and I followed these crazy conspiracy theories all around, like as the week went on, like trying to find out who was the Yellow King, what's Carcosa, and like people would just bandy stuff around, and Robin's like, no, did it all one go. I know everything. Just easier that way. So I gotta rewatch that actually. I was thinking about that the other day, but that was fun to watch with you guys. I had a good time with that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Revisiting early episodes, part of the fun is definitely going to be us talking about things that would go on to be these cultural phenomenon. Like Game of Thrones, for example. I guarantee that there is a podcast episode where I'm like, guys, are you watching Game of Thrones? This stuff's really good. Or like when I discovered Mad Men, and I watched all of Mad Men over the course of this podcast's history. So yeah, just charting those things and those cultural touchstones. There really are a lot of them. Talking about things like the Avengers, the first Avengers movie. You know, we did an early episode where we were talking about Marvel Phase 1 and the Avengers, and I think it's going to be pretty fun to revisit that, especially next year when Phase 3 is over, Infinity War is out, and it's such a huge franchise. It's crazy to think that this Marvel Cinematic Universe has been going on for a decade, but it's also neat to look back on when we talked about it and those early days. So yeah, I love that aspect of the show too. Just it, not only the TV shows that we followed live, but just all of these pop culture milestones that we've been around for.
I've actually thought of a reverse example of that, where it got progressively worse, because we started this podcast just when The Walking Dead was starting.
Oh, yeah.
And the first season, you were like, Robin, you got to see this. You're going to absolutely love it. You're a zombie movie fan. This show delivers everything it promises. And the first season was pretty amazing. It was only six or seven episodes long, and it had nonstop zombie attacks, nonstop action. But then after that, it just fell apart, and one of the fun parts of revisiting the show is probably seeing your disenchantment with The Walking Dead starting in season two. I know season two was a lull, and I think it redeemed itself a while in season three for a bit, and then it just fell apart again until you just gave up on it altogether. And I hung on to it a lot longer than you did, but I eventually gave up as well. And it's still going, but I have no desire to get back into it.
The show itself is The Walking Dead now.
It's true. But I still remember season two, you rambling, saying, okay, we're still at the farmhouse, and it's just them arguing and talking about Shane and Lori getting pregnant and whose baby it is. Where are the zombies and stuff? And it just would get more frustrating as it went along.
I discovered the comics of The Walking Dead while I was at university. So in the 3 years prior to starting the podcast, I got addicted to The Walking Dead comics, and the comics are fantastic. They hold up. They're still really good. And, but like, Shane is killed within the first few issues. Like, he dies very quickly, and the show just dragged out that plot arc in the most annoying, boring way. Yeah. Seeing the downfall of my brief love affair with The Walking Dead is no doubt a choice piece of shows from the back row history. But you guys, so you guys are actually, you're touching upon the question I wanted to ask, which was, what have you gotten out of the podcast? You know, I feel like we're all walking away with something. This podcast has, if nothing else, developed our ability to talk about film, because it's like a muscle. You know, we're doing this most of the time. We do this weekly, or we did this weekly. And so, just being able to talk about film, I think we're better at talking about it now than we ever have been in the past. But what have you guys gotten out of the episode, out of the podcast? Besides, of course, watching great TV, Robin.
Well, also great movies. Like, you have, like, opened up movies that I never would have heard of before, like Haozu. Like, I don't think I'd heard of that until you brought it up to me, and Love Exposure, and some of the and I think some of the modern horror films you've introduced to me, like Inside, which is one of the most terrific horror films I've ever seen, but I don't know if I would have heard of it if it wasn't for you. So that was pretty cool. But also just the chance to, like, chat about this stuff, because, like, I used to chat movies all the time when I was in film class and I was working at Blockbuster Video, but I've kind of moved on from there, so I don't encounter this working my regular government job where you can just show up every week and chat about the latest cult movies you've seen. So it's great to have this to be able to chat with other people with the same interests and open up other stuff to people as well, because I know I've introduced so many things to you guys that you hadn't heard of before, and you've done the same things to me, and that's pretty much the biggest takeaway from the podcast.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like a continuing film education. I may have founded the back row when I graduated from film school, or film studies, but I've certainly continued to learn all about various points in film history and learn, you know, take in all sorts of movies and TV that I might never have watched otherwise. And it's entirely because of you guys. I mean, TK, you have filled in my knowledge of, like, 1930s, 40s cinema in a huge way. Those 2 decades. Like, when I was in film studies, I studied that time as being, like, the Depression and the Second World War. I didn't really study it as much of, you know, the Cary Grant films or things like that. I was watching very different cinema and studying it through a very different lens. So you've really filled in my knowledge of that era of cinema, which is pretty great. There's a lot of really good stuff.
Shucks.
What about you, TK? What are you taking away from the podcast?
I've increased my film knowledge exponentially, I think, since we started. I think talking about it from week to week just gives you a kind of a deeper insight. Like, I pick up on tropes a lot faster now. I can recognize a lot more of that stuff. And I think it's, it's expanded my cultural knowledge quite a bit. And it's just been fun to, it's been nice having a scheduled few hours where I just shoot the shit with you guys about films once a week. That's been nice. Been consistently nice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't talk movies nearly as much with anyone else besides you guys. I like Caitlin. I talk to Caitlin a lot about movies and TV shows because we watch them together. But when it comes to sort of more in-depth analytical film discussion, it's like you guys, for sure. And here's something that has definitely come out of the back row and shows from the back row is, of course, The Trail Went Cold, Robin's ridiculously successful podcast, his true crime podcast. I mean, I don't know, Robin. I can't remember. Were you writing for Cracked before you wrote for the back row?
Oh, no, I didn't start writing for Crack till a couple years. The back row was kind of a warm-up act, but now I'm remembering that one of the very first articles I published on the back row was Robin's Top 10 Favorite Unsolved Mystery Segments, where I found clips of them on YouTube, and I decided to make a list of my favorite segments, and I seem to recall that was one of our more popular articles on the website, that people would, like, Google it and find the article, and that's kind of what got me interested again. So I don't know if we talked about it that much on the podcast, but you could say that the back row kind of planted the seed about the interest in true crime and unsolved mysteries, and it kind of evolved from there.
And it's fascinating to look back on that article because, of course, that was when Unsolved Mysteries was all over YouTube. It was like a whole other era of Unsolved Mysteries when people would post clips on YouTube from the show. It was before Cosgrove Murrer Productions took them all down and then came after us when we tried to do our own.
Yeah. That's kind of funny. You look at that list today, and the number one choice is my favorite segment is Aileen Conway, and that became the source of the first episode of The Trail Went Cold. So, once again, planting the seeds.
It's all connected. And you know what? I got to give major credit to Robin, because you were undoubtedly the biggest draw that the back row had in its roster. You know, there are a whole bunch of people who've contributed to the back row over the years. All different types of articles have been written, lots of different movie reviews, but your stuff, before they were stars especially, always got attention. Celebrities loved Before They Were Stars clips, where you would dig up a clip of Eli Roth as an extra in the background of a subway scene in Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, and he'd retweet it. Or you'd find a clip of Rob Corddry in a tutu doing a comedy act before he got famous, and he'd retweet it. So there are definitely, you know, you, and on top of that, your Underrated Gems columns wound up being cited on Wikipedia multiple times, multiple articles. So your stuff was definitely, it has always been the biggest draw to the back row. Something about the topics that you are interested in have by far the biggest appeal across the internet.
Well, bringing up the King of Comedy again, after I published the first Robin's Underrated Gems column about it, I was messaged by Faisal, who was on our show a couple times, and he said, "Oh my God, I read your article and I watched the King of Comedy and I loved it, man. Thank you so much." And I thought, hey, this is going to work out. This is going to be a popular column. And I've published so many of those articles, and I know you guys have seen a lot of the films that I've written about, but it just kind of spiraled from there.
And I think, aren't you like one of the major sources on Wikipedia in writing about the film Blue Collar?
Yes, that's the one where they have like an anecdote from on set where Richard Pryor, in a drug-fueled haze, supposedly pulled out a gun on the director, Paul Schrader, and said, "I am not going to film more than 3 takes for any of the scenes we do." And that's cited as a source on Wikipedia, but I think I got it from the IMDb trivia page, and I cannot 100% verify that that story is true. Like, all I know is that I read it on the internet, but I've never heard Paul Schrader ever confirm that story, so it's like, I have no idea, I can't verify for its authenticity, but somebody wrote that story on the Blue Collar Wikipedia page and cited my Robin's Underrated Gems column, so there you go.
You heard it here, folks. Robin says it's 100% true.
Yes. Well, Richard Pryor is dead now, so he won't come after me if it's not true, thankfully.
But, yeah, Before There Were Stars definitely, like, hit a lot of big celebrities. James Franco link to it? I think he was in like a Pizza Hut commercial.
Yes, because he wrote a column, like an article about how he used to work at Burger King or something like that when he was a struggling actor, and then said, "My very first acting job was a Pizza Hut commercial," and he put a link to it in the article, and we got tons of hits on the back row. It was the Washington Post, actually, that he wrote it for, so it was a mainstream publication, but it's like James Franco is definitely the biggest celebrity who has cited one of our Before They Were Stars things.
And all that stuff is pretty cool. I have to say, it really illustrated for me how the internet is, it's kind of like the great connector, man. Like, you know, who are we? Here's the thing. Who are we? Especially when we started this podcast. Like, we're just guys. We're just like former film students. We just love movies. You know, I would not say that we are major, I mean, Robin's sort of becoming a celebrity for sure, but at the time, we were just like dudes, you know, we were just a couple of dudes. And the fact that Eli Roth would retweet something that one of us wrote is just, it's kind of crazy. It's wild to think how easy it is to connect with people online, you know, just through doing things like that. It's also fun to see the things that come up when you Google topics that Robin has covered, because Robin's Underage Gems and Before They Were Stars have great SEO rankings. You Google turns your stuff up pretty frequently.
Just watch. It's going to go full circle. In a couple of years, someone's going to write a Before They Were Stars, and they're going to put a link to our shows from the back row saying, here's where Robin Ward, the host of The Trail Went Cold, started off on this little podcast, just three guys hanging around talking about movies.
Honestly, I fully expect it at this point. I really do. I'm sure it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, guys, do we have any other topics that we want to touch on? Again, I want to reiterate, it's not like we're just going to disappear in the ether here. You can certainly get in touch with us through Facebook. You can for sure reach me. And I mean, Robin is all over The Trail Went Cold on Facebook and on the website. And of course, you can just like leave messages on the website and stuff. We will get them. It's just a matter of closing down the podcast. So we're not going to be unreachable. We're not dying or disappearing. But guys, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Just say that thanks for the memories and for introducing me to so many different movies, because when I was thinking about Fantasia Fest again, it's like, I think I saw something like 7 movies one year and 10 movies the other year with you, and those were like all movies that I never would have seen if it wasn't for this podcast, probably.
Are you telling me you would not have sought out Dr. Proctor's fart powder on your own?
Well, if I had noticed it, I would have watched it, but I probably would not never heard of it if it wasn't for Fantasia Fest.
Yeah, just thanks. It's been a blast recording with you two over the last number of years. It's been such an established part of everything. It's been an absolute blast. It's been a lot of fun, guys, and I'm sad to see it go. I really am. But you know, we got bigger things to do and bigger things to find.
It's not goodbye. It'll take other forms, but I guarantee at least we three will continue talking about film. That's not going to stop anytime soon.
God, so, no.
We Eternians don't say goodbye. We say good journey.
Two Masters of the Universe references on this episode.
And where else would I be able to say that and you guys would get it instantly?
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for being a part of this. Man, I could never have known when I started doing this podcast where everything would end up. We've talked so much about the podcast itself, but looking back, it's pretty wild to think of just how much our lives have changed over the course of those 7 years. Like, when we started this podcast, I wasn't married. I didn't live in Toronto. Yeah, you know, I hadn't even worked on any real major motion pictures at the time. I wasn't a full-fledged professional video editor. I am now. It's wild to think about that. And this is always going to be a part of my life that I look back fondly upon. And I'm so glad that I have these recordings. It's going to be wild, like, 10 years from now, listening to some of those recordings from way back when we started. I already feel nostalgic for that moment. I just know it's going to happen. So
I just know I'm going to find so many opinions that I'm going to feel like, oh my God, did I actually say that I like that movie on a podcast? Oh my God.
Yeah, I can't wait. Maybe we'll have to revive the podcast for one episode when TK finally comes around and no longer likes the Brothers Grimm. Hey, when was the last time you watched it, Chris?
Last time we did.
Oh, there's a chance this might happen. But in the meantime, guys, let's play the final Ticket Price is Right, which is the box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released, and we discuss those predictions and who won. And this is it. This is the end of the Ticket Price is Right. We're not predicting any new movies. We are just talking about the scores for the movies we predicted last week and find out who won the final game. And before I even do that, I will reiterate. We started this in 2014, so we started this right around the same time as the Jupiter Ascending Countdown. I guess after a few years, I wanted to shake things up and add some more regular segments to the show. So in 2014, the winners of the Ticket Price is Right were both Robin and myself. We tied. And in 2015, Robin swept. And I remember, Robin, you just killed us. You demolished us in 2015. It was that year that it became a joke where we were like, well, what a surprise. Robin won all three movies every week. Because you were just on fire that year. 2016, I managed to win. And that brings us to the present. The three movies that we predicted totals for last time were All Saints, which is a Christian film, I guess. It was a religious film about a pastor. Birth of the Dragon, a Bruce Lee biopic. And Ballerina, which is an animated movie that had already been released in the UK. Truly, we were in the doldrums of late August. None of these were amazing films. So here we go. All Saints. I won. I said it would make $2 million. It made $1.5 million. Birth of the Dragon. Robin, you won. You said it would make $3 million. It made $2.7 million. And then Ballerina. I won because I had the low bid, $10 million, it made $4.7 million. So you know what that means. 2017 is a tie between me and TK.
Hey!
Congratulations, TK. Well done, well done. And for all that we joked about Robin being this Rain Man mastermind, I wound up having the most wins overall.
Oh my god!
But two of those were ties. It was one tie with Robin, one tie with TK. So, I don't know. In a way, it's kind of fitting, I guess. Well done, guys. And now, it's time for the dumb joke of forever.
Uh-oh.
And you know what? I've lined up a whole bunch of one-liners. We're doing a bunch of them. You guys know any jokes? Do you know any jokes you want to tell?
Not offhand, no.
Not offhand? I know a movie joke. I actually know a lot of movie jokes that people would tell on the set. Crew members would tell these on the set of made-for-TV movies that I worked on. Like, there was one where, why does the sound guy say 1-2, 1-2, check 1-2, 1-2? It's because if he said 1-2-3, he might have to lift something. Yeah, right?
Or,
how many directors does it take to screw in a light bulb? 100. One to screw in the light bulb, and the other 99 to say, I could have done that. But, you know, they're not very funny. They're very much like inside baseball industry jokes. So here are some dumb jokes that I like, and they're dumb, but they are not anywhere near the dumbest I've told. I just slapped Dwayne Johnson's ass. I've hit rock bottom. You know, Chris, I'm not letting you get away with being silent through all this. You can't just sit and pout while I tell these dumb jokes.
Yes, I can.
It's gonna take longer if you don't react.
He's never gonna stop if you don't react.
You know, Braille isn't hard to learn. You just have to get a feel for it. Hey, head over heels down a hill? That's just how I roll.
That's how everybody rolls.
I may have, and so here's a confession about the dumb joke of the week is I used to keep track of the dumb jokes of the week that I told, but the list got so long that it was just completely unmanageable. So I feel like I may have told this joke on the podcast before, but I love it. Did you guys know that garbage men don't get any training? They just pick it up as they go along.
No, you've used that joke before.
That's not fair.
Okay, but I haven't used this one, and here's the one I'll go out on. I don't know about you guys, but I like the smell of mothballs. But it's really hard to get their little legs apart. Love it. I like that. So,
I can hear the door slam in the background.
Yeah, really, TK is just gone. I got to save a bad one for the very end, because now he can find... You're free! TK, you're free! Freedom!
Hooray!
If you want to get in touch with us, I mean, you know how to find us. Just go to the-back-row.com and look us up on Facebook. The Back Row has a fan page. Message me through there. I probably won't be answering too much mail to my Back Row email account, but definitely the Back Row fan page on Facebook you can find me through. And Robin is going strong with the Trail Went Cold. Trailwentcold.com. You can find it through the-back-row.com. And on Facebook as well, like the fan page and ask to join the Trail Went Cold Facebook discussion group so you can talk about true crime with Robin and all of the listeners from the Trail Went Cold. And yeah, I mean, it all comes back to the Back Row, the-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening.